wanting to ride with us, Marcus said. Dom shrugged. Hey, he's been a lot less hostile in the last few days. He's just getting his second wind. The gear with Hoffman was Ty Caliso, another South Islander. Dom remembered him from Aspho Fields. It was hard to miss that shaved crest of dark hair and swirling tattoos covering half of his face. His armor and lancer were lavishly decorated, completely against regs, with tribal symbols scratched into the coating. It struck Dom that there were still a lot of gears left who'd taken part in that operation, including himself, and somehow it seemed a talisman that Aspho generally forged survivors. Generally. Hoffman took out his radio and flicked the transmit button.
Let's see if they've understood their instructions. Drivers, drivers, listen up.
He paused, stalking down the line of vehicles to peer into the first few cabs.
Rule one, stay in radio contact at all times. You won't be able to see what the hell's going on fore or aft, gentlemen, and if the shit hits the fan, then this is where your redirection will come from. Let me remind you that standard operating procedures are not a suggestion. You will maintain 100-meter intervals, you will clear a kill zone as fast as you can, you will not stop in a kill zone to rescue anyone, and if you find yourself trapped in a kill zone, you will use maximum firepower. Now, listen for your call sign and start your engines.
The convoy drivers were a mix of civvies and gears who could only handle light duties because of age or injury. Every truck, junker, and pickup had a gun mounted. With the armadillo APCs, that meant the convoy had a fair amount of firepower. There was even an old ambulance and a hearse, both cannoned up. But this wasn't an open road. It would bring its own problems, Don knew, but snaking through a city block by block, obstructed visibility, choke points, tight turns that an articulated truck couldn't tackle, was as risky as it got. Hoffman clipped the radio back on his webbing and headed for the command armadillo halfway down the convoy. Then he stopped and turned.
Caliso, you're with me. Phoenix, lead vehicle with Santiago and Rojas. Mataki, rear, with Cole and Baird. Get moving.
So Hoffman was coming after all, and taking the command vehicle. Well, nobody could accuse him of sloping shoulders on dangerous missions. Maybe he was bored. Maybe he had something to prove. And maybe the cog was just so short of men that it had to be done. How far have the grubs advanced? Rojas asked. I mean, how long have we got? Marcus popped the hatch on the lead armadillo and tapped Jack's housing. The bot, a self-propelling machine like an oversized and heavily armored thrash ball, lifted into the air on its jets and extended arms from recessed compartments, as if it was waking up and having a good stretch.
20 or 30 hours tops. Jack can do some recon when we get closer. It won't take us more than a couple of hours to reach North Gate. It's the loading that's going to take the time.
Is 3 armadillos enough for 50 vehicles?
Not really.
Didn't think so.
Rojas scrambled inside and settled happily into the gun position. Dom wondered what he would have done for a job in peacetime. Even though he'd lost so much in the war, he seemed to have an oddly innocent enthusiasm for fighting, and he didn't appear to have any vengeance or malice in him. Dom wanted to ask him how he dealt with it all, but he was afraid of shattering what might have been a fragile veneer. Every man had the right to cope in his own way.
Dom, you ever done this before?
Dom slid his black belt pouches around to the front to settle into the driver's seat and started the engine.
No.
It's all the same, Marcus said, climbing in beside him. Get in, get out, don't get in the other guy's way, and shoot it if it moves.
Marcus had a great way of simplifying apparently complex things. Maybe that science education hadn't been wasted after all. Command Vehicle, Center Convoy Group.
What's got into them?
Hoffman grunted. There were a lot of stranded out on the streets, more than he'd seen in years. Caliso tightened his grip on the wheel and slowed slightly to glance to the offside of the APC. The road was wide enough here to run alongside the main convoy for a while.
"Maybe they've discovered acceptance, sir." "Acceptance, my ass," Hoffman said. "Don't go mystic on me. They're loitering."
The convoy was now clear of the defended city and its invisible but very real boundary, and crossing the no-man's land peppered with stranded settlements that took their chances with locust incursions.
Settlements? How the hell could these people be settled?
Hoffman had once been troubled by the idea of humans, countrymen, migrants, whatever, being left unprotected, but only once. They hadn't been abandoned. They'd abandoned society, abandoned their own species. For a moment, Hoffman's eye saw the road surface ahead of him as pale, speckled rubble that had been hammered down again by time and movement. Then he realized that it was actually white marble fragments ground into the darker debris, the remains of a carved frieze that had run the length of the building to his right. It had been one of the finest archaeological museums in the world. He'd had his first serious dates here, hoping to persuade Nina Cladry that an enlisted grunt could be as high-minded as any officer cadet.
"Can't be what you're not. Shouldn't even try. Take pride in what you are."
An identifiable chunk of carved panel lying by the curb, a garlanded hand reaching out to him, translucent and white as death, made his scalp tighten. It was the essence of destruction, the last frantic clutch at life before sliding into the abyss. An elderly man, a rare sight here because stranded didn't live long, raised a ragged, filthy arm to give the armadillo a gesture. It wasn't exactly one of support for the troops.
"I think we can rule out gratitude."
The man was probably Hoffman's own age, but he looked twice that.
"Screw you too, citizen." "You'd think there was some festival going on." "Maybe they know something we don't."
Stranded were more an annoyance than a threat to the cog at the moment, but Hoffman still factored them into his plans. Reconstruction was going to be beyond hard. Shortages would go on not for months or years, but decades. He knew even now that the Army's first task, when the locusts were dealt with, would be controlling these huge anarchic gangs. It wasn't going to be pretty. He hadn't been scaremongering when he raised the prospect of civil war with Prescott.
"Caliso, slow right down, will you? I want to talk to them."
Caliso fumbled for his sidearm one-handed and tucked it under the webbing across his chest.
"Be careful, sir."
Hoffman made sure he had his own pistol to hand. It only took 1 second to find out that Stranded might risk shooting gears after all.
"I have to know."
The armadillo slowed to a crawl alongside 3 women, the mother and 2 daughters by the look of it, and Hoffman opened the nose hatch. Even in the open air, the smell of body odor hit him.
"Ladies," he called, managing to maintain a neutral tone, "what's everybody doing out on the streets?"
The woman stared at him. As far from his hazy memories of Nina Cladry as a female could possibly be.
"Not for throwing roses in your path, you fascist asshole. The locusts are on the run."
"You reckon?"
Hoffman said. "Yeah, we're the fascist assholes who die fighting them so you don't have to."
"Based on what?"
"You know damn well you're the ones who did it."
Stranded had their own ways of keeping an eye on locust activity. Hoffman added this to his list of rumors without taking any hope from it.
"Have a nice, independent, free-thinking day," he said, closing the hatches. "Step on it, private."
Caliso was a literal man when it suited him. He slammed the APC through its gears and sent it screaming up the near side of the convoy, cutting into the gap between the trucks.
"Hoffman to Phoenix Mataki. The Stranded think the locusts have packed their bags."
Hoffman kept his forefinger on the transmit key and pondered on his next comment.
Let's not be that optimistic. Hoffman out.
Caliso kept his eyes fixed on the tail of the truck in front. The jagged crest of hair gave him a look of permanent aggression, which wasn't far from the truth.
You think they're right?
He asked at last.
I'll believe it when I see the last grub laid dead at my feet. I'll do my best to make that happen, sir.
Yes, he would. The total sum of humanity now was just a medium-sized city by Cirrus' former standards, and Hoffman's army was more like a few brigades. He thought back to the Pendulum Wars, huge, continent-spanning, generously resourced by comparison, and almost felt nostalgic. Wasting 80 years fighting over emulsion supplies, over damn fuel, when all this was just around the corner. Hoffman had been born during war, and he expected to die the same way. There was nobody alive today who could remember Asira at peace. He took comfort from the thought that he wouldn't have had any idea what to do with peace anyway. Unsecured Zone, 5 kilometers from North Gate, rear APC. Bernie braced herself against the combing of the APC's top hatch, still trying to balance the muzzle of her newly acquired Lancer on something solid. The teeth of the chainsaw made it impossible. After a while, she gave up and took the weight with both hands. The noise of grinding tires and hammering engines concentrated in the canyon-like street was deafening. The tail of the last truck loomed. She pressed her mic closer to her mouth.
You're getting too close to the truck in front.
Shit, said the voice in her ear.
Now you're a backseat driver, too.
She cut off the mic and dipped down into the cabin so the conversation wouldn't be heard by everyone on the channel.
You need to give him enough room to back up if we hit trouble, dickhead. He can't do a U-turn in an Arctic. He'd just have to reverse over us.
Baird let the APC fall back a little, and she didn't need to see his face to guess how he felt about that. Marcus tolerated way too much shit from that kid. It had taken her an hour to form that opinion.
Happy now? Baird said. There's a good boy. Yes, Granny.
If Cole had said it, she would have found it funny, but this was Baird, so she didn't.
Son, if I bounced you on my knee, you wouldn't be able to sit down for a week, so shut it.
Cole roared with laughter.
You gonna get spanked, Damon.
Play nice and open the nose hatch.
He lobbed a few ration bars over the side toward a group of skinny, threadbare kids watching from a street corner like a pack of little animals. They pounced on the food. Bernie felt she was watching humanity de-evolve. Maybe that's the worst thing the grubs have done to us. They turned us back into savages. Baird sighed irritably.
Cole, what the hell are you doing? You need your calories, man. Don't encourage those parasites. Oh, come on, they're just kids. And you know what they grow into.
You never been hungry, Damon. You grew up rich. You got no idea.
Cole rustled through his pockets and threw something else out the hatch, as if he was making a point. Baird didn't shut it, oddly enough, as if he bowed to Cole's opinion.
And we get shitloads more to eat than they do. They hate us for it. Look at us. I mean, just look at how much meat we got on our bones compared to them.
That's 'cause we have to frickin' fight. They could put on armor and get the same.
Yeah, baby. I'll tell the next 8-year-old that.
Cole's tone was still genial, still patient, but it must have hit a nerve because Baird shut up. Bernie filed that away for future use. But it was time for her to lance the boil.
Are you pissed off because I kept my stripes, Baird? Well, a geriatric who's been sitting on her ass since before E-Day wouldn't be my first choice.
It just slipped out.
So, you obviously didn't get on with your mother. What about your dad? Did you ever find out who he was? Did she?
Great. You've just shown him he's getting to you. Baird didn't bite this time. She knew why. She'd crossed the line that this war had drawn, which was that jibes about family, however well meant, or not in this case, were well out of order. Everyone had lost family. A new social taboo had taken hold very quickly. And it was easy to assume that Baird didn't have feelings. Bernie wasn't planning to apologize, not yet anyway, and she wasn't his squad sergeant, just along for the ride while she got up to speed again, so there was probably no point wasting time on reaching an understanding with the mouthy little tosser. He was Marcus's problem.
The radio crackled. "Control to Delta. We have updates on locust activity. Stand by for transmission of new coordinates."
It was a woman's voice. Bernie struggled to place it.
"Still 2 kilometers southwest of your planned position."
Hoffman's voice cut into the circuit.
"How long does that give us to load, Lieutenant?"
"Whatever you can move in 26 hours, sir. The team at the location is prioritizing."
"Understood."
There was a sound of rustling paper. Cole was refolding his map. Bernie tried to recall the voice on the radio, but had to admit defeat.
"Cole, who was that?" she asked.
"Lieutenant Anya Stroud."
"Oh, yeah."
Now she remembered. Little blonde scrap of a thing, half the size of her mother in every way.
"Major Stroud's kid."
"Is she sweet on Dom?" Baird asked. "Seeing as you knew everyone when they were still in diapers. She always seems extra friendly with him."
Baird didn't know about Marcus, then. That was just as well.
"Everyone's friendly with Dom. The Santiago boys were always nice lads."
"You're going to give us a history lesson, then? How our jailbird sergeant got to be a hero?"
Even if she'd wanted to, Bernie had no idea where to start. And history was never as clear-cut as it looked, even if you'd been there in person and thought you remembered exactly how things were.
"Now," she said, "I'm not."
Chapter 5. I rarely see Marcus most days. I just don't know who he is, and it's all my fault. I lied to him about what happened to Elaine, and the longer I lie, the harder it is to come clean. Kids know when you're lying. Then their trust withers and dies. Adam Phoenix, confiding in a friend about his fears for his 17-year-old son. The Santiago house, Jacinto, 18 years ago, 4 years before E-Day. Dom sat on the edge of the chair, head lowered, elbows resting on his knees, and waited for the explosion. It never came. It might have been easier if it had.
"You're 16," his father said at last. "You're just 16.
"Dad, I can't walk away from this."
Dom could hear movement outside the living room door. Mom must have been listening.
"I have to do the right thing."
Eduardo Santiago squatted down in front of his son to look him in the eye.
"You really want to be married with a kid when you're still a kid yourself?"
"I'm not leaving Maria to go through this on her own," Dom said.
For some reason, his next thought was of Marcus.
"And I'm not going to have a kid of mine adopted by strangers."
Dom wasn't sure where that speech had sprung from. He had that out-of-body moment where he could hear himself the way his father might, and he sounded like a little boy repeating something he'd once heard a grown man say without any understanding of the meaning.
"But I mean it. I want to marry Maria. I always have. It's just more urgent now."
"Has she told her folks she's pregnant?"
"No."
Dom liked Maria's parents, but he'd never had to test their tolerance like this before.
"I plan to be with her when she does. I should tell them."
Eduardo stared into Dom's face, silent for a moment, and then smiled slowly.
"Yeah.
That's what I'd expect a man to do.
I'm scared, Dad.
I know.
Are you angry with me?
Not angry. I would have liked things to be different, but they aren't, so we'll help you as best we can.
I'm sorry. I let you down. Dom wasn't sure why he thought his father would be angry, because he never lost his temper. But this was something so serious that the old rules didn't apply. He seemed more sad and sentimental at that moment, the way he looked when he was remembering dead buddies from the army. He put his hands on Dom's shoulders.
"You never let me down, son," he said quietly. "I've never been more proud of you than I am now. It's easy to be brave when things are going okay, but the test of a man is how he handles himself when he's in a tight spot."
Dom didn't feel much like a man right then, and the confirmation that he really was in a tight spot, his father never pulled his punches, made his gut tighten like it did when Maria first told him she'd missed a period. He felt like a kid out of his depth, wishing he could turn back time, wishing he'd done things differently. He hadn't. He'd have to live with that. "It's just time. It's just early. We would have married and had a family anyway. After 3 or 4 years, it'll be like it was meant to be." "I'll tell Mom," he said at last. "Then I'll go see Maria's folks."
"Want me to come with you?"
"Thanks, but..."
"You can do the talking. I'll just stand behind you."
Eduardo Santiago always knew how to do things right for his kids. Dom longed to have that same deft touch with his own, always there when he was needed, smart enough to know when and how far to stand back. A baby on the way was a problem, but Dom's dread was rapidly giving way to a heady contentment with understanding just how much he could count on his family being there for him, even if he was determined not to burden them.
"Her dad's gonna go nuts," Dom said.
Knocking on the Flores's door was close to the hardest thing Dom had ever had to do, and it turned out to be Maria's mother who went the craziest.
"I'll give you full marks for guts, Dom," said Maria's father, patting his sobbing wife mechanically on the shoulder. "You'd better marry her, then."
They needed parental consent. Neither Dom nor Maria were old enough to buy a beer, but then there were soldiers fighting on the front line who weren't old enough to do that either. This was, Dom swore to himself, the last dumb thing he'd do in his life. He'd continue his studies, get a part-time job, and make something of himself for his wife and kid. It wasn't going to be easy. But maybe that was the point. If you got something wrong, you had to sweat a bit more to put it right, or you didn't learn a damn thing. And Carlos would be best man at the wedding, wearing his COG uniform. Carlos just seemed to get things right every time. Dom was more determined than ever to learn from his example. The Phoenix Estate, Jacinto, 4 years before E-Day. There was no way of sneaking up to the imposing front entrance of Marcus's home, even without the security cameras. The gravel driveway crunched under Carlos's brand-new army boots.
"Is it true you've got to pee on them to soften them up?" Marcus asked.
Carlos looked down. "That's leather boots. No, too many metal parts in these. You just break them in before they break you in."
"Looks like they're winning."
Carlos climbed the steps with some difficulty. He was still getting used to the thick soles and restricted movement of the knee-high boots.
"You'll see. With full armor, they look the business, and they work."
Debating the fashion appeal of army boots was just a distraction from the task that lay ahead. It wasn't Carlos who had to perform it, but his gut was churning anyway. Marcus's old man was going to hit the roof. Carlos found the Phoenix mansion more unsettling every time he visited. It wasn't so much a house as a statement. It said that it had always been here, it always would be, and that insects like him were so temporary that it wouldn't even bother to notice him.
Its massive columns and intricately carved tympanum told him to wipe his boots before he crossed the threshold, preferably through the tradesman's entrance around the back. This was a mausoleum, not a home. The statues in the ornate formal gardens that stretched as far as a city park now seemed more like gravestones. Jacinto's noises, traffic, distant voices, the steady hum of a city, stayed respectfully outside the high, vine-covered perimeter walls. It felt like all the life had been sucked out of the place. There probably hadn't been much to start with. Carlos just wanted to stay long enough to back up Marcus and then get out. "You still want to go through with this?" he said. Marcus stared at the big double doors as if willing them to open. The dark green paint was glass smooth and layers, years, generations deep. It was the portal to an alien world that Carlos glimpsed and never really understood. "Yeah," Marcus nodded. "More than ever." It was easy to forget that Marcus was the last and only son of a wealthy dynasty. Carlos didn't like to think of him that way. He was just Marcus, no heirs or graces. Professor Phoenix wanted Carlos to call him Adam, like he was everyone's buddy or something, but he would always be a man with a stack of titles and ranks. Carlos could never bring himself to do it. "Have I pushed you into this?" Carlos asked. "Are you just doing it because I did?" Marcus shook his head. "I knew this was the right thing to do years ago." When Marcus closed the doors behind them, Jacinto's sounds and smells vanished, and the two of them were instantly in another world. There was no sign of Professor Phoenix. How could you have a normal family life in a huge place like this, where you could easily avoid each other? You didn't need to sort out arguments here. You could just run away and hide from them. "Dad?" Marcus walked around the marbled hall, calling down the corridors that radiated from it. "Dad, where are you?" Carlos could hear footsteps approaching. He counted them. 23. It was a long corridor in a silent house. Adam Phoenix emerged from a doorway in an open-necked shirt, a small notebook in one hand. "I wasn't expecting you back yet," he nodded at Carlos. "Good to see you, Carlos. When are you off to basic?"
"Next week, sir."
Marcus interrupted. He didn't slip back into his posh accent this time, as if he'd finally given up fitting into his father's world.
"Dad, we have to talk. I've made a decision."
His father almost managed to keep his reaction nailed down, but, like Marcus, rapid blinking gave him away. He probably knew what was coming next. Carlos fought an urge to just leave them to it, but he had to stand by Marcus, even if he had no idea what backing him up meant in a polite upper-class family argument that was all raised eyebrows and no yelling.
"Is this what we've talked about before, Marcus?"
"Dad, I'm enlisting."
Professor Phoenix took his notebook and flexed it back and forth a few times in both hands, staring at it as if waiting for it to break apart.
"Well, you can still take an engineering course at the academy," he said.
No, he hadn't understood what Marcus meant at all.
"A military-sponsored education is as good as a civilian one. You could go on to La Croix for your postgraduate."
"No, Dad. I'm not going to be an officer, no commission, and I'm not going to university."
Marcus took a breath.
"I said enlist."
"I'm going to be an ordinary gear."
"Oh, not that again, Marcus."
Carlos said nothing. He almost felt guilty standing there in his uniform, as if he had a notice around his neck proclaiming, "I'm a bad influence." Professor Phoenix didn't even glance at him.
"It's done, Dad. I've got my letter to report to the recruiting office."
"It's not done. We've got to discuss this. You're throwing away a brilliant career."
"We've discussed it already."
Marcus drew himself up to his full height. It always looked threatening, even if he didn't mean to be, simply because he was so big now. It's okay for you to develop weapons, but not okay for me to fight? Carlos and the others can put their lives on the line, but the job's not good enough for your son?
I didn't say that, Marcus. Dad, I've got to do this. I can't sit out the war.
There's no got to about it. Nobody will think any less of you for not fighting.
I'll think less of me, and it's the only thing that's going to make me feel alive.
There was an awful, awkward silence. Eduardo Santiago would have hugged his sons and said whatever they did was okay by him. Professor Phoenix didn't seem to know how. His eyes locked onto Marcus's for a few moments, as if he was expecting him to back down. But then he turned to Carlos.
"Can't you talk any sense into him? You're the only person he listens to these days."
"Oh, boy." "Sir," Carlos said, "all I can tell you is that I'll make sure Marcus comes back in one piece." Adam Phoenix looked as if he was going to make one more attempt to talk Marcus out of it, jaw muscles twitching, but then his shoulders sagged, and he began fidgeting with the notebook again. Carlos felt sweat itching on his back, but didn't dare move a muscle. He was embarrassed. It was awful to have to watch this.
"Okay, I can't stop you," Professor Phoenix said. "And if I try, I'll lose you completely, won't I?"
Marcus avoided the question and rolled right past it.
"I'm going to give it 100%, Dad. Don't worry about me. Look, I'll be back for dinner tonight and... damn, I have to give a talk at the university."
They both looked defeated.
"Some other time, then," Marcus said, as if they were just business associates, unable to make a meeting. "Gotta go, Dad."
Carlos would have preferred a good, honest brawl with everything out in the open, dealt with and sorted. But people like the Phoenix family didn't seem to work the same way. Carlos followed Marcus back down the gravel path, and they walked aimlessly in silence until they reached the center of East Barricade and found a pavement cafe.
"Dom's getting married," Carlos said at last. "I didn't want to tell you until you got the thing with your dad over and done with. Maria's expecting a baby."
Marcus lost his glacial calm for a moment, just a flash of shock that raised his eyebrows. But that was a big deal for him.
"Wow," he said. "How did your parents take it?"
"Pretty well."
"How's he going to afford it? Is he dropping out of school?"
"Mom made him promise to finish his exams. You know Dom, he'll make it work."
"He needs money."
"Look, that's one thing I've got plenty of, and I could..."
"He'll be fine, thanks."
Carlos realized that sounded abrupt, but Dom would never accept money from anyone. He tried to soften the brush off.
"Shit, that was ungrateful. Sorry, Marcus. It's just that Dom won't feel he's a man if he can't support his family without help. Hey, maybe if we time it right, we can both attend the wedding in uniform. Classy."
"If that's an invitation, yes. Thanks."
"You don't need any invitation. You're an honorary Santiago. You're family."
Carlos leaned back in his seat and watched the ebb and flow of civilians enjoying the day. The war was a long way from Afira, at least geographically. Emotionally, though, the conflict was right here, in every home. After more than 70 years of fighting, almost every family had someone who had fought in the war, who was currently serving, or who worked in the defense industry. The reality of war was understood. Nobody could ignore it. Nobody wanted to.
"If we hadn't discovered emulsion, would we be fighting over other fuels instead? Water? Minerals? Trash ball?"
It didn't seem to matter now. Collecting enemies had its own inertia, and the cog had plenty. Carlos didn't worry much about the future because it was simply hard to imagine. But now, the future was actually in his own hands along with an assault rifle. It made him feel different. He was still trying to define how. Marcus looked lost in studying the surface of his coffee. He never said much about his father, but Carlo suspected he'd probably longed for congratulations and support for his decision, knowing all the time that he wouldn't get it. Maybe his whole life had been like that. It explained a lot. He had to jump through hoops to get a pat on the head.
"Tell me straight, Marcus." Carlos nudged his elbow. The spoon, resting on his saucer, clattered under the metal tabletop. "Are you doing this just because I enlisted, or to piss off your old man?"
"You need to ask me that?"
"Well, yeah. It's not like you tell me every cough and spit. I have to fill in the gaps."
Marcus's pauses often told Carlos a lot more than what he actually said. He stared into his cup again.
"Because it's the only place I'm going to feel at home, with people who understand me," he said at last.
"Shit, if anyone understands you, maybe they can explain you to me." Carlos managed to laugh.
Yeah, Marcus wanted the general camaraderie of army life, but he wanted to be with his buddy, too. Carlos understood that. It was weird to see a guy whose family had everything still looking for something they couldn't buy for him and didn't know how to give.
"It's going to be awesome, I know it."
Getting killed, wounded, crippled. Carlos couldn't dwell on that. It wasn't enough of a reason to stay at home. Besides, anyone who wasn't ready to fight for their country didn't deserve a damn thing from it. The Santiagos didn't freeload. The rest of that week became an avalanche of irreversible, life-changing decisions. At the recruiting office, Carlos waited for Marcus to come out of the medical examination. He could hear staff talking quietly behind a row of filing cabinets.
"That's definitely Major Phoenix's son," a male voice was saying.
Here, at least, old man Phoenix was still seen as an officer, not a scientist.
He could have walked straight into the academy. A staff college job, even.
"Maybe he wants to be a real gear," said another voice. "Not every guy wants the easiest path through life."
Yeah, they'd got Marcus about right. Maybe he wasn't so inscrutable after all. He seemed incredibly proud to wear the uniform, and Carlos had to admit the pair of them looked pretty damn good at Dom's wedding.
Dom made one glass of wine last for the whole wedding feast, as if he was afraid of what a few more drinks might do to him. It was weird to see him still as nervous as a kid, and yet also a married man with his own youngster on the way. Carlos knew it was the last time he'd see him in that state of limbo between boy and man.
"He's still my kid brother. He knows I'll always be here for him."
"I've got to talk it through with Maria," Dom said, nursing the glass in one hand. "But I'm going to get a full-time job, a real job."
"Mom's going to kill you. Still, nothing wrong with being a mechanic."
"No, I'm going to enlist."
"Shit, Dom."
"It's the pay," Dom said. "It's good money. I've got a family to feed now."
"Sure it is. I believe you."
Carlos gave him a ferocious hug and rumpled his fancy suit. He'd known Dom would join up sooner or later, but this soon... well, at least he could look out for him now.
"You're all about the money, right?"
At the beginning of Frost, Maria gave birth to a son, Benedicto. By thaw, Dom had dropped out of school and enlisted. There was the same inevitability about it as the seasons, Carlos decided. Some bonds could never be broken. The Santiago brothers, by blood or honorary membership, were going to be together for the rest of their lives.
Chapter 6.
A military life attracts young people for many reasons: duty, comradeship, purpose, the opportunity to test life to the limits, to learn a trade, escape from home, adventure, even patriotism. But for the youngster lacking a stable, caring home, it provides family, with all the security and meaning that goes with it. They crave the structure, approval, attention, and clear rules that their parents should have given them. and we can supply it. Colonel Gail Barrington, Head of Recruiting. Grounds of Pomeroy Barracks, south of Fira, regimental headquarters of the 26th Royal Tyrone Infantry, 17 years ago, 3 years before E-Day.
"Stand easy,"
said the sergeant, stacking mesh cages on the ground. The name tab on her fatigue said Mataki.
"I'm going to teach you how to live off the land, because you lads are going to have to survive in some pretty hostile places without the catering corps."
Sergeant Mataki was a tall woman in her 30s, built like a sprinter, hair scraped back under her cap, with a hint of an accent that Dom couldn't place. She opened the cage to haul out a live chicken and tucked it under her left arm. It clucked indignantly.
"If any of you are vegetarians," Mataki said, "it's tough shit. We'll do edible roots and fungi tomorrow."
Dom had busted a gut to get into commando training as soon as he turned 17, the youngest they'd take him. He'd relished the punishing course. He'd found hard-fighting aggression he'd never known he had. Maria was proud of him. Carlos and Marcus didn't look at him as the kid brother who needed taking care of any longer. He was, as one of the South Islanders put it, nails, as in hard as. And now, he was brought to a nervous standstill by a small black chicken. The dozen or so men with him were completely silent as Mataki stroked the chicken's head. It seemed quite relaxed in her grip, which Dom found disturbing. She wasn't one of the usual instructors. The badges on her arm indicated she was a sniper, but everyone said her bushcraft skills were the envy of the commando training unit. Someone said she could make a 6-course banquet out of 2 dead rats and a pile of grass cuttings.
"I'll show you how to trap birds and small animals later," she said. "That's the easy bit. For most of you city boys, this is the hard part. Because if you can't do this, your survival chances are shot to hell right away."
Dom was a city boy. Poultry came in sealed white plastic trays from the grocery store, already unrecognizable as the free spirit of nature it had once been. Poultry didn't look at him accusingly with pinprick pupils set in vivid orange eyes.
"You're all very quiet," Mataki said. "Come on. You're going to be commandos. You can shove a fighting knife in a guy's throat. What's the problem?"
Like she didn't know. She looked like she'd been here 100 times. Georg Timiu was standing just in front of Dom, and he could see the guy was edgy by the way his hands were clasped tight behind his back.
"The recruitment posters never said anything about strangling chickens, Sarge."
Mataki wasn't remotely like Major Hoffman. She had a sense of humor under that death's head badge somewhere. Dom saw a brief twitch of her lip as she looked down at her boots for a moment.
"We don't strangle, Private," she said at last. "We snap the neck quickly and humanely. You've already been trained to do that to a human. Chickens don't usually pull a knife on you."
City boys. Dom saw his baby son's toy animals in his mind's eye and felt deeply uncomfortable. But she was right. They'd all come from the infantry ranks, and they'd all been under fire and returned fire. Poultry shouldn't have fazed them. Mataki rearranged the bird head down.
"Right. Take both legs in your left hand like this, and hold the head between your right index and middle fingers. Other way around if you're left-handed, of course. Then you push down and turn your wrist like so."
It was the faint crack and the flapping that got to Dom.
"Oh, shit," said Timiu. "Just involuntary reflexes," Mataki said.
She made it all look easy. She plucked the carcass, showering glossy black feathers everywhere, and then drew a hunting knife to prepare it, impressing on the assembled trainee commandos that rupturing the bowel was a really bad idea, and that disposing of the feathers helped conceal their presence.
"Make sure you find the liver," she said,
displaying the alleged delicacy skewered on the tip of her blade.
Now your turn. All of you.
They got a chicken each. Dom was mortified.
I can do this. How hard can it be?
Let's get this right before I hand you back to Hoffman, she said kindly. I don't want him taking the piss out of any of you. I've never had a trainee fail yet.
It was pretty motivating. Hoffman wouldn't tolerate any squeamishness, and he certainly wouldn't have had the patience to do what Mataki did then. She walked up to Timiu, stood embarrassingly close behind him, and clamped her hands hard over his, right on right, left on left.
And push, she said. Crack.
She stepped back. Timiu stared at the bird, dead but still flapping wildly in his hand.
That's all the force you need to use, she said, or else you'll pull its bloody head off.
It got a lot easier after that. Dom still kept checking his dead chicken to make sure he couldn't feel a heartbeat before he started dismantling it. Mataki bent over him.
It's not first aid, Santiago, she said. The bloody thing isn't going to respond to CPR. Now pluck it, gut it, and cook it, because that's the only lunch you're getting today.
Yeah, it was dead. Dom fried the carefully dissected, bowel-free portions over a campfire in the wooded grounds, and made himself eat it, but he didn't like liver. Mataki strolled past, speared it on her knife, and ate it as she walked away. Timiu watched her go as if he didn't quite believe she existed.
"Why was that so hard?" Dom said. "Killing it, I mean."
Timiu gnawed on a thigh.
"Because the chicken isn't the enemy, and it isn't trying to kill us. It's like having to shoot your pet dog. Always harder to kill something innocent, even for the best of reasons."
It was just a chicken, and Dom reasoned that if you didn't have the balls to kill an animal yourself, you had no right to eat it. But it raised questions he had never considered before, like where the line lay between killing that bothered him and killing that didn't. What was he really capable of doing? Commando training had pushed him way beyond what he'd thought were his limits, leaving him with a certainty that he could take absolutely anything, survive anything, tackle any odds. It also made him wonder about the depths he might have to plumb, and whether he'd be able to live with himself if he did. I'll know the line between right and wrong when I see it. I know I will. But Dom concentrated on the sense of achievement. With Maria pregnant again, Dom didn't think life could get much better or more perfectly tailored to everything he'd ever wanted, even if he hadn't realized it until now. He loved being a gear. He loved it more than he'd ever imagined possible. The very real risk of ending up dead or disabled was simply there in the background, a statistical fact that rarely bothered him. But he wasn't the only one who'd found his vocation in uniform. Marcus, now Corporal Phoenix, had changed. He would never be the life and soul of the party, but he was as happy and at ease with himself as Dom had ever seen him. He was born to be a gear. In fact, he seemed happier with army life than Carlos. Carlos and Marcus were deployed again, back in Sarfuth, where winter was setting in. Dom read their usual joint letter. Marcus would write one half, Carlos the other, and Carlos sounded even more frustrated than he had a couple of weeks ago. This war would have been over a long time ago if the pen pushers at command listened to the guys on the ground. Some days I think they want me to put in a written request to take a leak. Marcus had added a comment below in very precise small handwriting. He always wants to take a leak. It's cold enough here to freeze the balls off Embry's statue. Marcus was developing a sense of humor. Carlos would have been happier as a commando, Dom decided. The rules were looser. A man could kick over the traces a little. Dom took out his pen, turned over the sheet of paper, and began writing a reply about the art of handling chickens. Sarfuth, Northern Region, Forward Operating Base, C Company 26 RTI. There was cold, and then there was cold. Carlos let the APC idle to reach running temperature, scarf pulled up over his nose while he sat in the cab of the vehicle with his hands tucked tight under his armpits. If the temperature dropped much more, the fuel was going to freeze solid in the engine. Shit! Anyone who is crazy enough to go sabotaging emulsion pipelines in this climate almost deserved a win. A shadow loomed in the windshield, blotting out the brilliant orange sunset, and then a gloved hand rubbed away at the layer of ice. It was Marcus, and even at minus freeze your ass off, he still wasn't wearing a helmet. He swung himself into the passenger seat. Carlos pulled his scarf down a notch to make himself heard. He didn't like helmets either, but at least he had the sense to wear a thermal cap. "You know how much body heat you lose through your head? Are you crazy? You want frostbite?" Marcus shrugged. 10%, he said. "And maybe. And no." He just wouldn't wear a helmet unless there was an officer around who'd stick him on a charge for it. Ever since the barber had given him his regulation crew cut on the first day, he'd taken one line of the COG uniform code to heart. A do-rag was acceptable headgear, as long as it was plain black, the ties were tucked away, and the cap badge was pinned centrally. Now he wore one all the time. Somehow it emphasized the hard angles in his face and made him look like a complete and utter bastard. That wasn't necessarily a bad thing, of course. "I just saw the KIA signals from HQ," Marcus said. The APC's heater roared like a blast furnace, but wasn't making a lot of difference to the temperature. "Captain Harry's is on the list." "Shit! What happened?" Harry's had picked up more decorations for gallantry than some regiments. She didn't seem the type to do anything as ordinary as dying. The news knocked Carlos back. "I didn't think anything could kill her." "She led a charge on a gun position. It didn't surrender fast enough for her." "Wow. Everyone's luck runs out eventually. If they push it." "Her son's in logistics, isn't he?" Marcus puffed clouds of vapor. They froze against the windshield. "Yeah. Same age as Dom." Dom. Carlos thought of him for a moment. Leaving someone alone and grieving when you were supposed to take care of them was pretty crappy. Like Marcus's mom. Oh, great. Carlos, long used to these one-sided, guess-what-he's-thinking conversations with Marcus, was again reminded that what his friend didn't say was every bit as meaningful as what he said. Carlos changed tack. Dead mothers wasn't what Marcus needed to dwell on today. "Well, our luck's holding out just fine. Let's get moving before my bladder freezes solid." "They're already talking about awarding her the Embry Star," Marcus said, almost under his breath. It was the highest decoration for bravery, awarded only to those who knowingly faced almost certain death to save comrades' lives. It usually ended up being posthumous. "At least she collected the full set of gongs." "Yeah, you get a free set of wine glasses in the afterlife for that." Marcus made a small ha sound and half-smiled, scraping away the ice forming on the inside of the windshield. Maybe he was hoping his mother had died heroically, too, not just run off and left him in an echoing silence with the stranger he called his father. He never said. He simply wrote a dutiful letter home once a month, from what Carlos had glimpsed, with no questions or recriminations, as if nothing much out of the ordinary had ever happened to the Phoenix family. The APC rumbled out past the checkpoint and headed for the pipeline that ran close to the border with Marinday, a neutral state with a careless way of letting indie bastards slip in and out to launch attacks. Porous border my ass. Complicity. That meant being careful about where you were standing when you shot them. Carlos was getting increasingly pissed off with the niceties of diplomacy. "They're a day overdue," Marcus said. He cradled his lancer in his arms as if he was keeping it warm.
Intel's source is slipping. Still no activity in the town.
Yeah, I'm never convinced their informant isn't just dicking with us.
Let's check with the snipers.
Marcus fiddled with his headset.
Alpha 5 to 30, sit rep, please. Over.
30 receiving.
It was Padrick, another South Islander. All the islands seemed to manufacture snipers in bulk, except Padrick was from migrant stock. He was conspicuously red-headed and freckled. It didn't go with his tribal tattoos, but he still had that islander attitude, so nobody thought it was wise to mention the fact.
"I've been watching some tosser digging animal traps along the pipeline for the last hour. He left 20 minutes ago. Check it out for us, will you?"
That could have been exactly what it seemed to be. The huntsman out trapping game attracted by the relative shelter of the overground pipeline. Or it might have been something a lot worse.
"What's your position, Pad?"
2QJO03134755.
Marcus carefully unfolded a map, a section at a time, barely moving his elbows from his sides, and folding the sheet back on itself to present the relevant part of the grid. His flashlight clicked on.
"You up on that hill?"
"No, not enough cover. We're laid up in a snow hole next to the descending section of the pipe, elevation of about 35 degrees from the valley floor."
Carlos glanced away from the snow-drifted road for a moment to glance at the map resting on Marcus's rifle. It was getting dark fast.
"They can see anything coming up the line."
"Yeah."
Padrick's voice crackled in Carlos's ear.
"We're waiting for the second shift. Let's hope they get a move on. Baz wants to watch the thrashball final."
He paused.
"I have visual on you now. The hole's a meter from the connection numbered 5 Bravo 9. See it?"
"Got it," said Carlos.
The pipeline was numbered along its length, so maintenance teams could identify sections.
"We'll take a look."
Baz was Padrick's spotter. The sniper teams could dig into a snow hole up here and almost make it a regular little home away from home, except for a sports channel. But they needed to. Laying explosive devices was done by stages here, and it could take days when it wasn't snowing enough to fill the holes. Carlos was fascinated by the efficiency. One scumbag would dig a hole and leave, then another scumbag would come along later and drop off the explosive. A little later, another would wander by and leave the detonators. Finally, a fourth would show up to assemble and prime the device before nipping off to detonate it remotely at his or her leisure. Nobody was left hanging around exposed for half an hour or more just asking to be spotted. It was random folks just passing by, and there were a couple of 100 miles of pipeline to choose from in the run from the emulsion extraction facility at Denava to the coastal refinery. All the COG forces could do was rely on tip-offs, tracking skills, and the psychological deterrent of making it very bad news to get caught. Carlos stopped the APC and cast around looking for the hole. It was about 0.5 meter deep, and there was a wire snare at the bottom. It was just about feasible that the guy was genuinely trapping the local rodents, which burrowed through the snow looking for food.
"Pad, it's a snare," he said on the radio. "But that doesn't mean it isn't a prep for a device."
"You're a paranoid after my own heart, mate."
"Let's recon farther down toward the town," Marcus said.
He stabbed at the map with a gloved finger.
"If there's a follow-up on the way, then maybe the timing's right."
"Keep the channel open," Patrick said. "The last patrol left the radio on transmit, the stupid bastards. If we'd needed them, I couldn't have flashed them."
"Don't worry, you got the grown-ups on task tonight," Carlos said. "Phoenix and Santiago."
"Yeah, the wankers who don't need helmets 'cause they don't have brains to blow out."
"We love you too, Pad."
"Flush 'em out our way."
Carlos killed the headlights and drove parallel with the pipeline at a sedate crawl. Anyone could hear the APC coming, but sometimes Carlos would still surprise the unwary if they were engrossed in a task. By the time they reached the likely entry point from Marinde, it was dark, and the pinprick light